This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The number of juveniles in adult jails and prisons went up more than 200% between 1990 and 2010, according to stats provided by the Sentencing Project. What is the cause of the rise in youth incarceration? A symposium on Friday at Northern Kentucky University will look into that. Joining Cincinnati Edition to discuss are Weaver Institute for Law and Psychiatry at the University of Cincinnati College of Law, Administrative Director A.J. Stefani. Welcome, A.J.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And Director of the Institute for Health Innovation at Northern Kentucky University, Dr. Valerie Hardcastle. Welcome, Valerie.
Thank you.
Join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter as well. We'll find your comments and your tweets there. So there's this symposium on Friday. What's the goal of it? What does it seek to accomplish?
Well, I think it's really a way to help explore the idea of, or try to answer the question of when it is that juveniles are considered so incorrigible that we need to keep them locked up in a prison facility essentially for the rest of their life, versus when can they be rehabilitated so that even if they've done something absolutely terrible, they can rejoin society at some point.
So does this symposium have a position on that, or will it explore a variety of perspectives?
Well, on the one hand, the symposium is billed as not providing the answer, but rather to get a variety of disciplinary perspectives around the question. But I would say probably the leaning of most of the people there is that we should think about juveniles who do things really bad things as somebody who potentially could be rehabilitated, largely because their brain isn't completely formed yet.
AJ, how important of an issue is this, the issue of youths being either tried as adults and then sentenced as adults into adult prison?
It's important, and it's a complex issue as well, right? There's the public policy perspective that says how should we be treating individuals around the ages of 16 and 17. That's primarily what we're talking about, juveniles of those ages. Should we treat them and view them more like children or more like adults? And that brings in a lot of kind of clinical information and knowledge that is important to consider in the question in terms of their brain development. And so as Valerie mentioned, we're going to be bringing in experts both who have a public policy perspective as well as kind of the neuroscience expertise to kind of look at the development of the child brain at that period of time. And there are differences. There are differences between male brains and female brains, and Valerie can probably talk for hours about that, right? But looking at this transition stage, and we've always struggled with this transition stage, and as you've noted, the number of juveniles who have been bound over or transferred to criminal court have increased tremendously over the last 20, 30 years. And that reflects something going on in our society.
And you both have professional backgrounds that include a focus on mental health in some capacity. Is that accurate?
Yes.
From different perspectives,
right?
But absolutely.
But the mental health field in some way. So what role does that play? What role does mental health play in the lives of juveniles who find themselves charged with serious crimes?
Well, I would say in a nutshell, and of course, you can always find exceptions, but it plays a huge role. I mean, it plays a role for most kids before they're even born, because a lot of kids who end up doing really bad things have parents who abuse drugs or at the least did not eat well, didn't get good prenatal care, and so they're already born behind the eight ball. And then if they grow up in an environment that is not nurturing, they're malnourished, they live in a violent area, and so forth, that too affects development. And so when you combine things like fetal alcohol syndrome or neonatal abstinence syndrome with an impoverished environment in which they're raised, there is a sense in which some of these kids just don't seem to have a chance. And all of those deal with mental or behavioral health. And so then the question is, going back to what AJ said, is, well, by the time you hit the ages of 16 and 17, are you already kind of, in some sense, formed into the sort of person you're going to be? Can we say, okay, whether it's society's fault, your parents' fault, your fault, do you now have a bad character such that we need to lock you up? Or are there things that we could still do at that age that would help you become a functioning member of society?
So that's the mental health of perhaps a young offender who's found themselves in a tough situation. But what happens in terms of the mental toll on these folks, when on these young people, when they're sentenced to an adult prison, when they're spending this incarceration in an adult prison? What is that toll on their mental state?
Yeah, that's looking, you know, at the other side of it, looking at the back end, what happens after they're adjudicated delinquent in juvenile court or found guilty in regular criminal court. And both systems in most states struggle with the issue of providing adequate mental health treatment in correctional facilities. And I'm not going to speculate as to which state does it best or which system Ohio or Kentucky does better at. But both systems really struggle to develop and provide really functional and useful mental health treatment, both in the juvenile justice system and in adult jails and prisons.
What are some of the key differences between the juvenile justice systems in Ohio and Kentucky?
Differences between the two systems?
In the way that they approach sentencing?
Well, in general, the juvenile court comes at the question from a different perspective. It views the offender not as someone to be punished for what they've done, but as someone, hopefully, that can be rehabilitated. And so both states in general have several different methods through which they can decide this question, whether the 16 or 17-year-old is better dealt with at the juvenile court or in the criminal court. For some sorts of serious, very serious charges, they're automatically bound over to criminal court. In most cases, the juvenile court judge then makes a determination based upon a whole number of different factors, whether they're more appropriately addressed in juvenile court, which has a whole different language to it. They're not found guilty, right? They're adjudicated delinquent. And an entirely different approach to the question than criminal court.
The youth incarceration rate in our three local states, according to the American Civil Liberties Union, is that Ohio has locked up 198 per 100,000 youths. Kentucky has locked up 163 per 100,000. And Indiana has locked up 258 per 100,000. And that's just incarcerations. That's not necessarily any data related to who's in which kind of prison. But those are the rates overall. The American Bar Association reports that in the 18th century, there was no distinction in America between juvenile and adult offenders. And that changed in New York in 1825, but the first juvenile court was not established until 1899.
In Chicago,
right? In Chicago. So that suggests that this is a country that has struggled for a long time with how to deal with its youth who have committed crimes.
Right. This was and 1899 was a noteworthy year, right? You have kind of the beginning of what we would think of as the progressive era. This optimism that science and that new kinds of knowledge can help to solve many of our social problems, right? Before the turn of the century, we generally didn't think of children very much, we didn't regard them as important, nearly as important as we do today, in part because child deaths were much more common at that age. Many children were viewed as labor to be, you know, used, you know, worked, they worked the farms and so forth. And so what we see during this period of time is an emphasis at looking at children as not fully formed adults, but potential adults. And then you see juvenile courts and that model being developed very, very quickly after Chicago first did it in 1899. So by the time you got to about 1920 or 1930, almost all of the states had some sort of juvenile court system.
So now, 100 years after 120 years after that, in your line of work or at events like the symposium coming up on Friday, is there any state or jurisdiction that is heralded as a good example? This is the area that has it right. We should follow this model.
I would have to say no, not in particular, because I think the issue isn't which model you follow, but rather how you think about punishment and what punishment or rehabilitation is supposed to mean, particularly when you're at the sort of transitional age. And I think it's important to note that on the one hand, yes, it's been 120 years since we started diverting youth into a different type of judicial system. But on the other hand, it was only in 2013 when the Supreme Court said that you automatically can't sentence juveniles to life without parole. And so I would say there was a fast evolution, but also there's been an extremely slow evolution at trying to marry what we do in the court system with what we know about how juveniles' brains work and how their behavior is caused.
Do you think when you try to have the conversation about youth incarceration rates, talking about youth who have been convicted of committing some kind of crime, regardless of the level, do you think that they're generally less sympathetic to the public in general because they're technically criminals? Is that part of the problem here?
Well, I guess I would say I think the crime matters. If you swipe a candy bar, I think people are willing to overlook that if you're a teenager. If you gun down 12 people in cold blood, I think people are not willing to overlook that because you're a teenager. And I think they're much more inclined to try to judge you as an adult, as somebody who's fully responsible for that behavior.
So when you talk about the heinousness of a crime of gunning down people, someone who might be the same age as a petty theft, is not that teen still going through the same brain development situation that you were talking about earlier? Is that not something that should be considered when that person is being sentenced as well?
That is my personal belief, yes, that we do need to take into consideration brain development, which is not to say I think, well, that person automatically should roam free. That's not what I'm saying, but rather recognize that whatever system they end up in, whether it's an adult system or a juvenile system, that there is an opportunity here to shape behavior in a way that you don't have that same opportunity if that person were 45 and did the same thing. So there is an opportunity that I think both systems don't take fully take advantage of.
Is there part of the population that's more frequently impacted by adult sentences on juveniles than others, like a disparity between white juvenile sentences and black juvenile sentences?
Part of the problem with juvenile court systems across the country, and it should be noted that we don't have one juvenile court system. We actually have 51, right? And the federal courts actually have limited jurisdiction over, offenses committed by juveniles in national parks and so forth. But you have tremendous state-by-state variation in the way these systems work. And even within those states, you see differences from county to county and municipality to municipality. One of the big challenges is simply data gathering. Our court systems in general don't do a great job of having a central location for providing data to, so researchers can kind of look at these questions. Juvenile court systems are even more opaque. They're right. They're very, very difficult to get good data about actually what's going on.
I'll read something from the American Bar Association. Statistics compiled from 15 states revealed that juveniles prosecuted in adult court and released from state prisons were rearrested 82% of the time. So that's juveniles who were prosecuted and then sent to the adult prison. They were rearrested almost 100%. You're 82%. That's an overwhelming majority of these folks came out of there. Studies have also shown that juveniles prosecuted in juvenile court, though, benefit from the services made available to them through that process, as juvenile institutions provide programs and resources specifically designed for juvenile development. So there is data that shows the outcomes are better for these juveniles when it comes to reoffense and other opportunities if they go through the juvenile process. So why aren't the powers that be or whoever may have control over some semblance of reform in this matter, if that's what people are advocating for, why isn't that happening?
Well, I think you have to go back to the sorts of crimes that juveniles get sent to try it as adults for versus what they go to a juvenile detention center for. And so, for example, if you do murder a bunch of people, in general, the community is not going to want you to be released when you turn 21, which is what would happen if you went to juvenile court, although sometimes you get bound over into adult prisons. And so that's one of the big differences. And I think a lot of this just has to do with society's reaction to what happens when really, really bad things happen in your community and what you want to do about it. And in general, the reaction is one of retribution. And so the sentiment, by and large, is when you do something really terrible is going to happen to you in turn, which means adult prison for kids.
What do we know about the experience in an adult prison of, say, a 17-year-old who committed a crime and was bound over to an adult prison? Are they targets for abuse? Do they have tougher times than older inmates? Do we know anything about that?
I don't think either of us have looked at that question specifically, but I would have to imagine they're among the more vulnerable individuals, right? And particularly when you're going into a state prison or a federal prison at that age, you can't realistically expect your life to get better, right? If somebody said that when we take people who have proven themselves to be bad at making decisions and you put them in an environment where they're not allowed to make meaningful decisions, why do we expect them to be better decision makers when they come out?
A website called NOLA, which specializes in legal content, lists some of the pros and cons of having a juvenile case in adult court. So they've identified some pros for juveniles to be tried in adult court. And one of them is that minors have the right to a jury trial in adult court if they
Correct.
Want. And that juries in adult court may be more sympathetic to a minor. Is there evidence to support that?
You will sometimes find prosecutors, in addition, willing to make plea bargains in adult court that you wouldn't find in juvenile court. So if you speak to some defense attorneys, they will actually prefer their client to be bound over to adult court, knowing that they're going to end up with a more favorable outcome, fewer days locked up for their client in criminal court rather than juvenile court.
Another pro is that in some jurisdictions where dockets and jails are crowded, is that the court may be inclined to dispose of the juvenile's case more quickly to
right.
impose a lighter sentence,
exactly.
like you said. And then disadvantages, which we've kind of covered some of these, certainly juveniles subject to more severe sentences in a juvenile court. Is that accurate?
Well, they can be sentenced to, certainly, because they can get life. They can have an effective life sentence, which you really can't get in a juvenile court. And I think, as AJ mentioned before, there really are fewer services. So the whole guiding philosophy behind the adult prison system is very different than what you find, what it's supposed to be in a juvenile system.
And here's one that we haven't covered that I would imagine would be a pretty significant issue for young people's future after they get out. It's that adult criminal records are harder to seal or to
right.
expunge than juvenile records.
Right.
So,
this idea of the juvenile court is very opaque. It's a very, very opaque to us. Kind of looking at what happens from a macro perspective as well as on an individual's perspective. They're not open to the public like regular criminal trials are.
The symposium Youth Tried as Adults will be held on Friday, May 3rd, 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. in room 107 B and C at the Student Union of Northern Kentucky.
And walk-ins
University.
Are welcome. Absolutely.
All right. Walk-ins, welcome to this symposium. So let me thank both of you for being here today. AJ Stefani, thank you. And Dr. Valerie Hardcastle, appreciate both your time.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.